Am I on now? Ooh. Ah, I could have just talked louder. Yakima refers to itself as the Las Vegas of the North, and it's in the North, and that's about the only thing that is true in that statement. But we left this conference at about midnight in a snowstorm, and we were going up over the mountains down the other side, and we felt that we needed some sustenance in case we broke down, got snowbound, and so we went to Krispy Kreme donuts, which have no nutritional value in them whatsoever other than just it is pure sugar into your system. And several boxes were bought, and Stuart was in the back of the van. And we heard nothing much from Stuart really all night, as he had a whole box to himself. And it was full when we left Seattle, it was empty. 12 had gone by the time we got to Yakima. But since then, he and I have both slimmed down. Matthew 11, verse 28, says this. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And you're in this series in Matthew's Gospel, and Matthew's a really interesting book, actually, because it was originally written to a Jewish audience. And so Matthew assumes that his readers, he assumes an awful lot. He assumes that his readers understand Judaism. And sometimes 2 millennia later, when we read Matthew's Gospel, we miss things, or more likely we're left scratching our heads and sort of saying to ourselves, what on earth is going on here? What on earth do you mean by that, Jesus? And so when we just read that passage, when I first read it, I have some immediate questions with the text, and I have some feelings about what Jesus is actually saying. For instance, like, well, Jesus, how can a yoke be light? Have you ever seen a yoke? I mean, they're heavy things. I mean, it's just like, this is a contradiction, Jesus. Jesus, I'm knackered. You're promising me rest. And what are you giving me? You're giving me this heavy thing to put on my shoulders. All I want is rest. Aren't you contradicting yourself? Jesus, one minute it's a heavy yoke. The next minute it's rest. And then you go on and say, well, I'm gentle and humble. And I don't think that's terribly gentle of you, Jesus, to put a great big heavy yoke on me. And Jesus, just to me, it all seems like works, works, works. And it's just... Stop. You've completely missed the point of what Jesus is saying. This passage can only really be understood if we get into the Jewishness of what Jesus said. Now, I know this is going to shock some of you, and I apologize in advance, but Jesus was not actually Swedish, blonde, and wore white long robes and floated over, you know, Palestine, first century Palestine. He was a Jew. And what this passage is all about is actually, what does it mean to be a disciple? What does it mean to be a follower of Jesus? What does it mean to follow Jesus as our teacher for how to do life well? And so this morning, we're going to start here in Matthew 11, but we're going to flip all the way around Matthew's Gospel in order to try and understand what Jesus is getting at here. And we're going to look at another Jewish writer as well. What does it really mean to take Jesus' yoke? How do we find rest in Jesus? Especially this Jesus who claims, or at least here he claims, to be gentle and humble in heart. So we're going to go on a little journey of discovery this morning. So stay with me. I'll give you the references. You won't get lost, I promise me. Just strap your seatbelts in. Emergency exits are there and there. An oxygen mask will descend if you feel slightly nervous. Ready? So I've got a question to start with. Does it really make any difference if you make a profession of faith in Jesus? Sure, you may be sitting here this morning thinking, well, Jesus, yeah, you're a good guy. Or maybe you go a little bit further, a great moral teacher, maybe a worker of miracles, a religious sage. But does it make any difference to what you believe about Jesus? Well, let me come at that the issue in a slightly different way. But it's the starting point to understanding what Jesus is going on about in this passage. And maybe this question isn't always in the forefront of our thinking, but it's always swirling around there, especially if you and I are trying to be disciples of Jesus. And the question is this: how do we do the right things? How do I become the kind of person who does the right thing? You know, not lie, even if it would be convenient to lie, or not cheat on my tax return, or how about helping out our neighbor or our spouse, particularly when we don't want to? And particularly when there's something interesting on TV and they're summoning us to... Or on the other hand, how do you do those little unseen things consistently? Because we're just trying to do the right thing. Because I think fundamentally we know that those endless choices that we make to do the right thing opposed to the wrong thing ultimately shape us into the kind of person that we're going to become. So how do we do right things? Well, fundamentally it has to do with how we see ourselves. If we want to be disciples, if we want to be followers of Jesus, that the kind of people that consistently do the right thing, then it ultimately comes down to how we see ourselves. Now stick a finger in Matthew 11. Go forward a few chapters and find Matthew 14, which is page 981 in the Bibles in the pews. I've been waiting to say that phrase for so many years. But you haven't got pews. The Bible's in the seats. Matthew 14, verse 25 says this. During the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and they cried out in fear. "Ah!" That's what it says. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage, it's I, don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. Then Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came towards Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" The disciples have been out all night trying to cross the lake. It's about 3 a.m. It's choppy. The wind's against them. They think they see Jesus walking to them on the water, but that doesn't really compute because people don't walk on the water. And so they think, well, it's got to be a ghost. But Jesus assures them that it's him. So Peter gets out of the boat and goes towards Jesus. What was Peter thinking? I mean, had he had a lobotomy that night? I mean, has he just completely lost it? Why does Peter suddenly think he can walk on water? Why is Peter so impulsive? Now, to understand this story, you've got to understand the context. Okay, I'll let you in on a little secret. Jesus was a Jew. He was a Jewish rabbi. He was a teacher living in the first century in Galilee. And in that time, they believed that a prophet named Moses, from centuries earlier, had known God and had given them the Torah, which we now know as the first 5 books of the Bible, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. And the Torah was God's revelation to the Jews for how they were to live. And it was known as the Way. And the Torah was the center of Jewish life, and it was also the center of their education system. So everyone went to school about age 6, boys and girls, and school was known as Bet Sefer. And they would go to school up until about the age of 10, and they would learn the Torah by heart. And they'd be taught in the local synagogue by the Torah teacher or rabbi, and they would memorize Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy by heart. That's a lot of words. By heart. At the end of Bet Sefer, most kids would then go and learn the family trade. They'd go become an apprentice, or they'd go and learn how to manage the household, or they'd get married off, and they'd become farmers, carpenters, fishermen. But the best of the best would be invited to continue in their studies. And they would go to what was called Bet Talmud. And on top of further studies in the Torah, they would memorize the rest of the Hebrew scriptures. That's Genesis to Malachi, by heart. That's even more words. Bet Talmud would finish about age 15 or 16. And after Bet Talmud, the best of the best of the best would be invited to go to Bet Midrash. And only a very select few would be invited to go to Bet Midrash. And with Bet Midrash, what you did was you went and found a rabbi and asked, "Can I be your disciple?" Now, a disciple didn't just want to know what the rabbi does. A disciple wants to be like the rabbi, wants to learn to do what the rabbi does, and wants to become like the rabbi. And the rabbis were responsible in that society. Society for interpreting and understanding Hebrew scriptures. They were the most revered members of Jewish society. And they all had their different interpretations of the scriptures, and this was known as their yoke. Ah, that word from Matthew 11. Jesus talks about a yoke. Anyway, let's continue the story. Therefore, this kid, best of the best of the best, would come to a rabbi and ask, can I be your disciple? Can I take on your yoke? So that I in turn can spread your yoke to others. Why? Because he wants to fully understand the scriptures, he wants to understand the rabbi's interpretation, and so become a disciple and ultimately become like his rabbi and make more disciples. So what would happen is the rabbi would quiz the kid at length, searching out whether the kid really knew the Hebrew scriptures. He would quiz him on Torah, the prophets, the oral traditions of the rabbis, many, many, many questions. And in most cases, the rabbi at the end would say, well, you clearly know the scriptures, you clearly love God, but go and pursue the family business. Go and become an apprentice in a trade. Become a carpenter, a farmer, a fisherman. But in a few cases, the rabbi would see something in this kid, and this kid is the best of the best of the best of the best. And he would say to the kid, come, follow me. Because I believe you can become like me. And the child would leave family, friends, synagogue, village, farms, fields, and go and follow his rabbi. And he would devote his entire life to do, to know, and become like his rabbi. And these rabbis would take their disciples all over Judea as they taught in the synagogues. And frequently what you'd see is this scene of a rabbi coming into the village, and behind him would be his disciples following in the master's footsteps. And they'd be covered in whatever the master had trodden in, and in which in that climate was pretty dusty. So there's this saying amongst the wise men of the first century. They'd say to the disciples of rabbis, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbis. So there you have it. That's what it means to be a disciple. Aren't you glad to discover that to be a disciple, you have to be the best of the best of the best of the best. Not only that, you have to be chosen by the most revered person in society, and you've got to devote your entire life to it. Easy. Well, I can imagine what's going on in your minds just right now, thinking, well, actually, Andrew, I'm not the best of the best of the best. So what hope do I have of being a disciple? Maybe it really is pointless, this whole thing of trying to follow Jesus. Let's go back to the first century. Rabbis began teaching and having disciples at about age 30. And so here we have this rabbi called Jesus walking down a beach, and he comes to Peter and Andrew, fishermen. Still Matthew 11? Let's go to Matthew 4, page 968. I'm going to pick it up in verse 18. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I'll make you fishers of men. At once they left their nets and followed him. Now, if they're fishermen, and Jesus is calling them to be disciples, then they're not following another rabbi, are they? And if they're not following another rabbi, then they're not the best of the best of the best. They didn't make the cut. They don't measure up. Then the text goes on and says, well, they dropped their nets and followed Jesus. And have you ever thought, actually, that's really odd. To drop everything and follow Jesus, isn't that a little strange, a little rash? However, in its original context, the incident makes perfect sense. If only the best of the best of the best are chosen to be disciples, here's Jesus, a rabbi, the most revered member in society, choosing Peter and Andrew, who didn't measure up in their world's eyes, to be disciples. So of course you'd drop your nets. The text goes on. Jesus walks a little bit further up the beach and he meets James and his brother John. This is verse 21. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. They were in a boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets, Jesus called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Here are James and John. They're apprentices. They're learning the family trade. They're not good enough to be disciples. And Jesus calls them too. And they're probably 15, 16, at max 20. They're not old men, they're young. And Jesus chooses them too. Jesus chooses then, and he still chooses today, anybody's for his movement. Because his movement's open to everybody. He chooses those that were always on the beating. Those that never made the first 15. Those who are not the best of the best. He chooses them to be his disciples. And in the case of the original disciples, they changed the course of human history. Paul, another Jew, another follower of Jesus, wrote this. Don't need to turn to this, but this is 1 Corinthians 1. Brothers and sisters, think what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so that no one may boast before him. Back to the story of Peter walking on water, or more accurately, it should be called Peter sinking spectacularly in Lake Galilee. Now remember, the disciples think it's a ghost, but even after Jesus' assurance, Peter calls out, well look, Jesus, if it is you, then you tell me to come. Now why is Peter's first reaction to ask Jesus to tell him to come? Because Jesus is a disciple. Because Peter is a disciple. He's orientated his whole life to knowing and being and doing like Jesus. So if it is his rabbi, Jesus, and this rabbi walks on water, then Peter can walk on water. Rabbis walk on water, disciples walk on water. Because this is what disciples do. They do the things that their masters do. They be the things that their rabbis are. That they know the things that their rabbis know. Disciples want to be just like their rabbi. And literally and metaphorically, they want to wear the yoke. So with the wind blowing, the waves going up and down, Jesus says to Peter, come. So Peter gets out of the boat, and all the other disciples go, loser. This is the Homer Simpson moment in the Bible. And he walks on water. Then the text says he got frightened. And he started to sink. And Peter cries out to Jesus, Jesus, save me. Jesus grabs him and says to Peter, why do you have so little faith? Now, why did Jesus say that? Now, if you read most of the commentaries, what they'll tell you is that Peter sank because he lost his faith in Jesus. That Peter doubts Jesus. But Jesus isn't sinking. Jesus is doing this. Surfing with style and no board. Quite happy. What happened was that Peter doubted himself. He loses faith in himself that he can actually be like his rabbi. He doubts because he thinks, actually, I can't be like Jesus. Yet Jesus wouldn't have called him out of the boat if he didn't think Peter could be like him. But Peter, you can walk on water. Nevertheless, Jesus chose Peter because he thinks Peter can be like him. In fact, elsewhere Jesus tells his disciples, you didn't choose me, I chose you. Why? Because I think you can be like me. You can do what I do, Jesus says. That's why I chose you. Jesus has this faith in this bunch of nobodies. These people who were not the best of the best of the best. But better than that, Jesus has faith that you and I can be like him. Now, in church we talk lots about believing in God. But God believes in us. In you. Now, sure, faith in Jesus is important, but what about Jesus' faith in us? Jesus must have faith in us because he leaves it in the hands of these disciples, these antibodies. And what's the last thing Jesus says to them? Right at the end of Matthew's Gospel, in Matthew 28, Jesus says, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations." He could have quite easily said, "Go and yoke people. Baptize them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teach them to obey everything I've commanded you. And surely I'm with you always, to the end of the age." Jesus says to them and to us, "You go make more disciples." And Jesus leaves it in the hands of these anybodies, the not best of the best of the best. Here's a thought. What if we can actually be the kinds of people that God created us to be? What if we can be the kind of community of disciples that Jesus meant us to be? What if we can be yoked to Jesus? What if we can wear that yoke? What if Jesus actually believes that about you, about Alma? But what if God believes that we can be the kind of people who live like Jesus lived? What if Alma can be like those first disciples? A bunch of nobodies, anybodies. The kind of people in church who take action because we're aware of all these endless opportunities around us to extend God's kingdom. All the time, opportunities for good and for beauty and for truth. And Jesus actually has faith that you can follow him. That I can follow him, that we can be like him. He believes it. Maybe for you this morning, this is the first time you've ever heard the fact that Jesus believes in you. That you can be like Jesus. That Jesus invites you to step out of the boat and walk on water. Because that's what disciples do. See, what if Jesus has chosen you? Then you can do this stuff. You can follow him, you can think like him, you can be like him, you can do the things that he did. Back to Matthew 11. Jesus, so he says, "Come to me. Take my yoke. Take my teachings, my being, my doing. I believe you can be like me." And then, in that, you'll find rest. Because he believes in us. He believes we can be like him. Ever seen the difference in someone's life when you tell them that you believe in them? You can do this. That's what Jesus says to you this morning. I believe in you. You can be just like me. You can do what I do. All of it. You can do it. Because I chose you. And I see the potential that my Father put in you. Why don't we pray? May you believe in God. But may you see and come to see that God believes in you. May you have faith in Jesus. But may you come to see that Jesus has faith that you can be like him. A person of love and compassion and truth. A person of forgiveness and peace. And grace, and joy, and hope. May you be covered in the dust of your Rabbi Jesus. And may you take his yoke and find rest. Amen.